This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's something for you. Are you ready? I mean, are you ready to put your predictions to the test? With Interactive Brokers Forecast Trader, you can trade your views on key economic and even climate indicators. Simply answer yes or no. For example, will the change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.6%? Or will the average U.S. temperature in 2024 be greater than 54 degrees? If you agree, buy a yes contract. If you don't, buy a no. It's that easy. Contracts cost 2 to 99 cents. Correct positions and predictions earn $1 at settlement, and incorrect ones settle at zero. Forecast contracts are commission-free, plus earn 4.83% APY on your investment with an incentive coupon. Visit ibkr.com/forecast and make your predictions today. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed leaves rates unchanged. No surprise there. Boomerang markets closing the month on a high note. And earnings rolling in with good and bad news. Our guest, noted author and president of Lifetime Perspectives, Dr. Roger Silk. All this and much more on episode number 880 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's August 2024, rolling in. What looked like a potential rolling over for markets was perhaps just a pause. We talked about that last week on DH Unplugged, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Interesting action. We did go into correction territory for some stocks, but I mean, these days, let's face it, it takes a day to unwind weeks of corrective action and easily snap back. And that's exactly what we saw. One of the big reasons is something we've been talking about, you know, over and over and over again for some time. And this is the idea that many of these big names are really ruling the markets. In particular, we saw last week when Powell spoke on Wednesday. It was Wednesday he spoke. The fact is that, no, rates didn't move. And he talked about things like, well, we made a lot of progress, et cetera. But the earnings from AMD that came out on Tuesday night really lit a spark on many of the semiconductors, saying there's maybe not as bad as they thought, raising guidance by them. And even though AMD came out and there were, I think it was up, what, 10 or 11% in the pre-markets and overnights on Tuesday through Wednesday, closed much lower than that. Did go up, but did close lower than that on that day. NVIDIA was just rallying, and the 13 or so percent rally by NVIDIA, a $3 trillion stock, moves markets. That's just the bottom line and how it works. Even though Microsoft didn't do as well, you know, so we saw that there's a lot of different cross currents going on right now. And we look at, you know, what happened with Microsoft really fell short on their Azure. And that's a big issue. And you would have expected a lot of things to roll over. In fact, on the news of Microsoft, it was down and cut below overnight its 200-day moving average. It really moved lower, but then popped right back up to close only marginally down that day, and then we saw what happened the rest of the week. But the truth of the matter is that what's happening is these big names are holding up relatively well, even though over the last several weeks, we saw this major corrective action happen. Just takes a day or so, and, well, that's what happens. And in the world of, I guess, computer-assisted trading, it makes it all that more emotional for some what's going on. By way of introduction, before I go even further down this hole, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and after 3 decades, I'll tell you, in this business, three decades, I've seen a lot of that period. I've seen a lot of changes. I've seen a lot of things that have just totally gone, you know, from one end of the spectrum on how we would research things to the other end, which is almost instantaneous. And one thing that we can count on is that there will be change. Change is inevitable. The fact is that we need to keep on top of it. And how we deal with that is really important. And I think for me, I need to understand what is happening and cut through the noise and get to the facts, if I can. Sometimes you can't get that far. Sometimes the noise or the fat is so thick, you just can't get to the meat. And you know why I need to do that? Because I'm in a different position than you are, probably. Many of you. Because I run or invest money for people other than myself. Of course, I invest my own money, but I'm saying we invest money for other people and we have to keep a lot of the emotional decision-making out of the formula. And I know it's really hard. In my first book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, I start a chapter off with the idea that, you know, emotions would be left at the door when you invest. And I got to tell you something. That was I wrote back in 2007, and I still believe that. But I got to tell you, when it comes to your money, sometimes it makes sense to have a little bit of emotion, that emotion that will kick in to keep you out of trouble. That's what it does, right? It's like, hey, it's hot over there. I'm not going to touch it. And that's instinctual. And sometimes the emotions are that part of your instinctual being that keeps you out of doing things that really you shouldn't be doing. And of course, there are times it can really cause havoc, though. Because sometimes a feeling, there's something in the pit of my stomach. I think that, oh, boy, markets are too low or too high, or I should get on or get out. But don't beat yourself up because you made bad decisions. There's a lot of people that make decisions based on emotions, because the thing is, all you have to do is when you're finding yourself on the wrong side of the equation. This is pretty easy. It's going to come out very, very basic. Just get back to center. Do what you do. It's not too late. It's never too late. Keep investing wisely for your future. And this idea that I can't do it, I've come to, you know, I'm too scared. Hit the reset button. Maybe you're feeling flustered, frustrated, but that's what you need to do. You need to get yourself back to the point of center and make decisions from that point. Whether that means cleaning out your portfolio and going to square one and then rebuilding, or just starting from cash and starting to invest. Lots of different ways to do that. You know, we talk about different ways and theories, one foot in, one foot out, the lobster trap, you know, the flower garden, all these things that we have talked about for years on this show is things that I'm hoping that you're doing right now. Sometimes you can't. I get it. That's when you need to get professional help. I'm not talking about psychological. I'm talking about investment help. And when it comes to these difficult decisions, I got to tell you, you know what? What we're going to do today is we're going to turn to somebody who can probably help us out with a lot of this. He is the author of the book, The Investor's Dilemma Decoded. The Investor's Dilemma Decoded. That's our guest this week, Roger Silk. And he's a CEO of Sterling Foundation Management and president of Lifetime Perspectives. He's widely recognized as a leading expert and innovator in the emerging field at the intersection of finance and philanthropy. He's been doing this more than three decades himself, working with and advising wealthy clients, high net worth families. He's the author of several books, including Managing Foundations and Charitable Trusts, Creating a Private Foundation, and Politicians Spend, We Pay. He's been published in articles in Estate Planning Magazine, Trust and Estate, spoken to an audience around the country. And how about we just get right to that? He was also a treasury officer at the World Bank, where he was responsible for a multi-billion-dollar repo portfolio. So he's got the cred. Let's bring him on. And as mentioned, our guest today is Dr. Roger Silk. And we're going to talk with him about some of the things that he does, as well as the fascinating book that he wrote, The Investor's Dilemma Decoded. Dr. Silk, how are you?
Very well, Andrew. Thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks. I may slip into Roger as we get
please,
along here.
Please do.
or doctor. So I think, first of all, I got to ask you, you know, this book that you wrote here, The Investor's Dilemma Decoded, why that title?
There's so much noise out there, Andrew, about investing. There are podcasts, there are websites, there are news feeds, multiple news feeds, people talking. There are still some newspapers out there. There are people selling products. And what we were looking to do is try to take a step back. Suppose you didn't know where to pay attention. What we are trying to do, what I think we've done, is start from the beginning, build it up block by block to enable a reader who has finished the book and understood more or less what we're doing to make his or her own informed decisions about that makes sense, that doesn't make sense. And so we were looking for a catchy way to encompass that idea. And we think that the Investor's Dilemma Decoded does that.
There's a big dilemma because we have this dilemma in society right now, the idea that what information do we trust? And that has been, I don't even know what multiple level comparison to, let's say, to, you know, 5 years ago, well, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, right? What we thought was really truth back 25 years ago may or may not have been, I'm just saying, right? But that's what we held to be the truth. These days, the information is coming from so many sources. How do we figure out what fire hose to drink out of?
Andrew, that is such a great point. And I think, you know, those of us who have been around for a while and are somewhat reflective realize we believe things and we don't even know why we believe them. We can't. It's like, you know, whether it's something in history or something in medicine or something in politics or something about economics or something, almost any area, if you're careful and you ask yourself, what do I believe and why do I believe it? Unless you've really done your homework, you're going to find, at least I find, I have these beliefs and I don't even know whether they're true or how I even got them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you find yourself doing that?
Of course. I'm like, yeah, I think this. You know, I mean, there was, you know, for a long time, you know, this is a stupid thing, but for a long time, I'm like, you know what? I can't eat any cheese. It just doesn't work for me. I mean, my stomach gets all wacko. I thought I was lactose intolerant and all that. And I stayed away from all cheese. Then I started reading about, well, there are some cheeses that don't have lactose in it. So I always thought I was lactose intolerant, right? So I eat these cheeses that are lactose free. And I'm like, still bothering my stomach. What's going on there? So I never got to the bottom of it yet. I still don't eat cheese. I don't care. But the point is that, you know, that's one crazy thing, right? But you look at other things about, you know, where there's certain places and restaurants. And I'm like, I don't like that place because, you know, the people are a lot older there and it kind of creeps me out. Or I believe that, you know, this TV station is telling the truth and this one isn't. And I do ask myself, well, how come the other people think the opposite? And who's right in this equation? Are these the things you're talking about?
Those are some of the things. I'll give you other examples. So in, I don't think anybody really cares about the politics of this anymore, but if you go back to just after the founding of the United States and the, there were the Jeffersonians and the Hamiltonians, mm-hmm. and there was the clash of views when Alexander Hamilton won, and he wanted to set up the first bank of the United States. Right now, this is admittedly history that most people probably learned in school and forgot. But the history that you learn is all about how this was necessary for the good of the country, and it was all sunshine and daylight and roses. Mm-hmm. But Catherine and I were going back and actually studying the events. And when you study it and you take away the preconceptions, you come away with a pretty strong idea that actually what Hamilton was doing was, you know, the first instance in the United States, and we're talking 1790, so really right after the founding, is crony capitalism. So what he did was he funded this bank by issuing, so they had a charter, right? They were basically a monopoly bank, and they were going to earn big profits. And I'll give you one guess as to who was able to purchase the shares.
Yeah, of course. He and his family, right?
Well, and his friends, right?
Friends and family, yeah.
And I never learned that in history books. You learn the opposite. So that's what I'm saying. It's not just things, you know, today. I think it's been that way always. I mean, the newspapers, of course, they predated the networks and stuff, but they started out as partisan. And it was only, I think, you know, those of us who grew up with, you know, when I was a kid, it was Walter Cronkite, right? And we all believed that, you know, Walter Cronkite told us the objective truth, right? I don't know if you believe that.
Sure. But Walter Cronkite. And that's the news. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And it's interesting, by the way, you mentioned Catherine. Let me just tell and briefly tell our audience, who's Catherine? Who's this person, Catherine? Catherine is Roger's daughter, and they work together actually on this book. And they have, they do business together in various ways and different companies, right? But still working together on different functions in the world of business.
That's right, Andrew, and thanks for mentioning that. And so our company is Sterling Foundation Management. And, you know, it's interesting because we don't manage money. We don't do investments. We don't give investment advice. So why are we writing a book about investing? And it actually, in my mind, in our minds, it's directly related to the question that we were just discussing, which is, well, everybody seems to have an axe, right? Not literally everybody, but the typical investment book is written by somebody that's promoting in some particular approach to investing because that's what they do.
Right.
And so we thought it would be helpful because our marketplace is by and large, it tends towards high net worth because we're sort of in the philanthropy space and, I mean, everybody gives philanthropy, but it's really typically high net worth who.
Well, there's different levels too. Yeah, there's philanthropy of giving money and giving goods. Then there's philanthropy of let me see how this can actually benefit the charity, but also my financial situation. Which nothing wrong with that. Everybody wins.
Nothing wrong with that, Andrew. And you know what? I'll tell you another one of these. I think it was. Well, it's attributed to people like Mark Twain, and you know, the old joke is something about, you know, 85% of the facts on the internet are made up, and that is attributed to like Abraham Lincoln or something.
Right.
It turns out that most of these or a lot of these great sounding quotations that get attributed to Mark Twain or Ben Franklin or, you know, some big figure, and then you can't find when they actually said it. But somebody said, you know, it's not the things we know that get us into trouble. It's the things we know that ain't so.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point about people using philanthropic tools for the tax benefits. I mean, I was doing this for a long time and anybody would come to me, I would say, don't think about philanthropy unless you want to support charity. But then a few years ago, we had some situations and client situations, advisors asking us, and we had to really, really reface that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered I'm a little bit embarrassed. It took me this long to figure it out. But in fact, there are some very useful tools from the charitable world, Andrew, that can really help. Mostly high net worth people, but people, investors,
right?
Particularly people who have capital gain property, they might not really care very much about charity. It might not be their first or second or third priority. I mean, they can't really be dead set against it.
Right.
But there are tools out there, and we kind of figured this out. And as far as I know, we're sort of on the cutting edge of that. Perfectly legal. But charity will eventually benefit. So it's not like nobody's getting cheated or anything. But the point is that I've been doing this for, you know, 30 plus years, and it only in the last several years that I realized, oh, something that I always believed isn't actually correct, and there's a better way to do it.
That is, and this is important why we're getting into this, I think, because I think that a lot of people believe that, so I can tell you things. I have friends that say, no, I can't invest in the stock market. I'm like, well, why not? Well, you know, it's risky. I'm like, okay, I need to hold on to my money. I'm like, okay, so what are you doing? Well, I just got it in the bank, or I just got it in a money market or something like that. I'm like, okay, so this is, let's fast forward 10 years from now, 10 years from when that was said. And they're like, I'm like, do you realize that the money you could have had if even you had just slightly invested? Yeah, but it just, the whole thing is always going down. I'm like, what are you talking about? And we go through this whole thing, and their belief is the stock market, because they must have been slammed at one point or another, is just this terrible place that, you know, you just lose money. And what happened is that the entire universe of investments, they put the poo-poo on, because it was all somehow related. So the our paradigms, our way of thinking, can really be, on one hand, can be very good and powerful, right? We could use that to our benefit. On the other hand, you know, when we get stuck in these endless circuits that just keep on going back to the same place, and our minds are playing tricks on us, we could really do a lot of damage to ourselves personally or financially or others, right?
I completely agree with you. So in our book, we actually look at this exact question of, and because what you said, people, I don't want to, it's not that people are, they don't have an emotional opinion about stocks per se. They think they're risky.
Right.
And it's risk that people don't like. And of course, nobody likes risk except maybe gamblers, but, and they, you know, hopefully are doing that as a consumption and they know what they're doing. But when you're investing, you don't like risk. No one does. One of the things that we develop in the book is, well, what does risk actually mean for you? And of course, the academics have a very mathematical definition of risk, however they define it, right?
It's, well, you can have standard deviation, downside risk. You could say, you know, up down volume area, up down ratios with the, right.
Yeah.
Or comparative.
Comparative. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, for most people, frankly, it's like, unless you're a professional, it's like, that doesn't mean much to me. So one of the things that we did was we said, well, we think that most people, I mean, people that we're really talking to, risk is, I want to make sure I don't run out of money, right? I mean, typical person wants to have enough money, right? It's more important that they have enough to do what they want than that they become, you know, a billionaire. So one of the things we do, we have a whole chapter on it, is we basically said, let's massively oversimplify the world and say there's only two categories of investment. Let's say there's a riskless investment, we'll call that cash or T-bills. Mm-hmm. And then let's just call something the market, right? Mm-hmm. And how you define the market, maybe it's the S&P, maybe it's the whole world, maybe it's MSCI, you know. But, and we do go into some of those things. But just so at a very high level, you have two potential assets. Because again, we're trying to simplify this, because unless you become a professional, there's no way you can wrap your mind around everything that you can do.
Right. So
you can do riskless or risky. Obviously, riskless has lower volatility, but also a low return. And really the long run real rate of return on riskless investment has been zero. Mm-hmm. You know, you're lucky if you, T-bills, as you know, over the last 25 years, have actually had negative real rate of return, which is kind of shocking. Another one of those things we think we know, but then you look at the actual facts, it's not even true. It's like people think T-bills are riskless, but real returns on T-bills, basically during that really low interest rate period, negative.
But that brings me to that next point, though. You know, what is risk? How do we define risk? Because is risk the risk of movement of the actual instrument up and down? And if it was, that is the only definition, then T-bills, you know, you look at, and what time horizon, and we'll get to that other point. I want to ask that question in a second. But if you say, well, as long as I get my money back in the end plus interest in the interim, that's not risk. But then we add in and overlay the idea of inflation. And you start saying, well, what about, you know, the fact that you're going to have the actual valuation degrade over time and your purchasing power risk is a problem, right? I mean, so we could layer on what are the questions associated with risk. Because when I think of this, and then I'll let you talk about these two things. So one is the overlays of what risk is to what does that mean? But the second thing is, when I start talking about risk and I have a client's like, well, I don't want to lose money. I'm like, well, over what term? Well, I don't care if like in 5 years, there's been some ups and downs, but like they can't deal with the fact that if they put money to work, it's going to be down tomorrow or it's going to be down 20% over the next 3 months. So time horizon becomes extraordinarily important in the, I think, and a good education in this. I can't stress this enough. From my perspective, I'd like to hear yours after, but from my perspective, the idea of time horizon has been overwhelmingly, and by the way, I've changed this over the years, and I've come to the conclusion it's probably one of the most important things that we look at when talking to clients. So now I'll pass it off to you.
I agree again, Andrew, with everything you said, because your risk, are we talking today, tomorrow, next week, or as you say, next year or 30 years from now? And I have a couple of comments on that. We think that what most people who are investors truly care about is that longer run, right? If you said, you know, you're going to retire whenever, 30 years, whenever you're going to retire, you can have enough money then, even though, as you just said, you got a lot of ups and downs along the way. Oh, yeah, that's fine. I'll do that, right? Most people would say that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, well, I was talking to my son the other day. He has a degree in finance. He works in the industry. He knows all the theory, but when it comes to taking his hard-earned money and investing it,
mm-hmm.
like all of us, I think, you know, he said he was going to, you know, the pretty bad period in the market the last few weeks.
Right.
And so he said that he had, and we're not talking big money, right? We're talking basically his monthly, you know, the amount that he takes out of his pay and invests on a monthly basis. And he just happened to be telling me that, yeah, I was happy because, you know, I kind of dragged my feet and the market went down. And so I felt a lot better than if I had put it in at the beginning. Even, you know, we're talking a week because right, that's just so totally human nature.
Right.
No one wants to feel, oh, I was stupid, even though you can't possibly know. I mean, I think we all agree that in the short run, the markets are essentially random.
Correct. And there's no way to assign an appropriate level of risk for anybody. But the worst thing that can happen is, you know, if a client that's been out of the market forever and they're finally getting in, and we have some solutions to that too, which I'm sure you talk about. But but I think it's really important to drill into people's heads, especially listeners are listening right now, about the idea of what is actual risk. If you have a 30-year time horizon, what are we even talking about, you know, today or tomorrow for?
So what we did in the book is we built a model, you know, and people don't have to worry about the details of the model, but basically say, you know, make a lot of simplifying assumptions. Like I was saying, you know, you could have a riskless, call it T-bills, and just say the expected real return on that's zero, long run.
Right.
And of course, we have to ignore taxes. Yeah, in order for the real world is so complicated that all we're trying to do here is give people some opportunity to see, okay, we make some simplifying assumptions. What do those imply, right? And so we said you could either put any percentage in either T-bills or we chose the World Equity Portfolio. We based it on the Dimson, Marsh, and Staunton data. You're mm-hmm. probably familiar with that.
Yep.
I think it's the best data set for global that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, let's just say that going, you know, looking ahead is going to be relatively like looking back. And of course, nobody knows, but it's the best we can do. And so we said 6.6 real. And I think that's about what their total global portfolio has done real over the last 100 and something years. And then we said, well, if you just do that, you invest the same amount of money. Let's assume that you start when you're 25. And then again, we had to make a bunch of simplifying assumptions. But you invest a certain amount every year until you retire. And then you live a certain number more years on your spending, right? So during your working years, you're earning, retirement years, you're spending. Same amount, level spending the whole.
Uh-huh.
And then we looked at what is your probability of having enough money? And the way we did the probability was, you know, we did all the stochastic analysis and then we did the percentiles and we worked it out that way. It's in the book. But basically, if you do the quote unquote safe thing and keep all your money in T-bills, and you know this, you're not, unless you save some gigantic fraction of your income, you're not going to have enough money. You're going to run out of money.
That's correct.
And so if you're young and you're starting out, and almost contrary to what we've all kind of absorbed from the culture, you're least risky if you're measuring risk by, am I going to have enough for retirement?
Yeah, small caps.
You're least risky. Your least risky is like 90 or 100% in equities.
Right.
Yeah, you know that because you've looked at this stuff. But anyway, I think that's, we're not recommending because there's more choices than that, but it's like, you know, Clausewitz said that, you know, no plan survives contact with the enemy. And it's the same way. You make a plan when you're 25, one out of a billion people maybe actually carries out the plan that
they have to change it. But I want to switch gears for a second, but I want to take a break, but I want to talk about the biggest asset class in the world and what you found and how that works in a portfolio. But hang on one second, let's take a quick break. So let's talk about Interactive Brokers. At Interactive Brokers, you don't have to wait for the markets to open. Did you know that? With around-the-clock trading, you can trade over 10,000 U.S. listed stocks and ETFs, even U.S. equity index options and U.S. Treasury bonds. Around-the-clock trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and capture more market opportunities. This flexibility allows you to trade on your timetable and invest during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock. Because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. And we're back with Dr. Roger Silk. The book is The Investor's Dilemma Decoded. And we've been talking about the areas of risk, mindsets, paradigms. We've been talking about, you know, the idea that that sometimes we questioned, didn't we? Like, why do we believe that? And we looked at, you know, risk. I want to talk about and start talking about some of the other items that you looked into in this book. And you looked at the biggest asset class in the world, real estate, right? And,
right.
You know, I don't usually talk about real estate on the show. What I mean by that is I don't bring on guests that fully are all about real estate. And I don't do that because it's too complicated. And it's too, you know, what are they pushing, you know? But, and the other reason is that usually in a very liquid portfolio, it's very difficult to get some of that. You know, we use REITs and things like that. But tell me about like farmland, residential, office. I mean, a lot of things going on there these days. And what are we supposed to expect from returns there?
Another great question, Andrew. And I know we only have a certain amount of time, but
yeah.
So we try to say, because I'm sure you, I mean, I grew up in Southern California in the 70s and 80s. And people, it seemed, were making money hand over fist by owning a home.
Mm-hmm.
And until the financial crisis, it was a very, very common trope. You can't lose money in real estate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we had a generation sort of was taught that, and it turned out to not be true. And so we went back and say, okay, let's forget what we think we know. Let's see what the actual data shows. So we looked at farmland, which is one class, I mean, a subclass of real estate. We looked at office buildings, and we looked at essentially income residential and owner-occupied residential. So that's kind of four categories. I'll try to go through them real quick. It's in the book, and there's a lot of detail in there. And this is kind of a start with farmland. You know, right now we hear, oh, the Chinese are buying up the farmland. Bill Gates is buying up the farmland. Oh, such a terrible crisis. Actually, I expect that the returns to farmland from people buying it today, we're talking cropland in the, you know, like Midwest, you know, soybean, wheat, are going to be very, very modest. And the reason that I think that is you as an investment guy are going to instantly understand this valuation, right? You pay too much for something. It doesn't matter how good the investment, how good the underlying is. Your returns aren't going to be very good.
Right.
So over the long run, the return to farmland in the U.S., and the data goes back to the 1870s, I think. I'm not looking at it right now. I'm just doing this from memory. Is basically the what they call the cash rent yield. And maybe keep up with inflation. The capital value of the land basically maintains its real value. So you're basically earning. So put that into language that people don't understand. I buy an acre of farmland for make up nice round numbers so people can follow it. $1,000, which is way too cheap, but I just want a nice round number. And I'm not a farmer, which is like half the farmland out there is rented out to people who do farm it. And you get your rent. That's what you get. You don't have a whole lot of, you got to pay your taxes, but you don't have a whole lot of costs because typically the farmer takes care of all that. So I might be renting it out for $30 a year, which is about 3%. That's my expected return.
Right.
And that's where we are today, roughly. I mean, obviously it depends a little bit. It's like, varies a little bit, but cash rent returns are pretty low. And then you want to go one more layer. You maybe peel it away, say, okay, what determines that cash rent? And ultimately it's the productivity of the land, right? The productivity of farmland is the farm crops. And in the Midwest, it's beans and, wheat and corn.
And that, but the thing is that real estate itself may or may not have any other uses. Like you look at some places where you have an income producing vehicle on the property, right? That's the same thing. That's a farmland, right? It's an income producing generating business from the property itself. Whereas another one of those similarly could be a tract of land that someone bought and they put a storage facility on it or a bowling alley, for God's sakes, or something like that, just to make money in the interim to eventually sell it for a higher price when maybe the expansion of a city or a town, you know, is required, right? Different and similar.
Yeah, that's what I would consider more land speculation. Okay. And I think, you know, 30 years ago, I remember having a conversation with a guy who was then running the one of the real estate units. I think it was for Goldman Sachs. Anyway, he said that in the real world, in order to make money speculating in land, you really have to be right. He says, because it's going to really eat you up at the rate of about 8% a year just to kind of hold it. And so, you know, that's going to be, it has to double in you know, 8 years, 9 years, just to get your money back, just to break even. So land speculation, I have no opinions about land speculation, except you really got to know what you're doing or be really
lucky. I would go with it. I would agree.
But I think investing is kind of different from speculation, even though it's hard to draw a bright line between the two. And then you look at apartment buildings. And over the long run, the data suggests that apartment buildings, the return again to apartment buildings is essentially going to be your net rents and you're probably going to keep up with inflation on average. Mm-hmm. We look at office buildings, which are tough because every office building is sort of a unique property. I mean, obviously, it's a unique property. There was a really, really interesting study that was done in New York City. And we talk about it in the book. The researchers were trying to say, okay, so New York, like there was probably not a more robust city from the 20th century, from 1900 to 2000 in the whole world than New York City. I mean, you can maybe think of one, but I can't.
I agree.
And so they said, well, wonder what the returns to owning commercial real, essentially office buildings was. And so what they did was they went through all the big project, you can imagine. They went through all the real estate transit because they're public record. And what they were looking for was the same building selling twice in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So that they're comparing apples to apples, right?
Sure, yeah.
You know, you buy a parking lot and you put the World Trade Center on it. That's not apples to apples.
Right.
So they took the same building and they found, I think, 80 something examples. They did all the math. They did all they got. End of the day, I'll let you guess what they found.
Didn't keep pace with inflation?
It kept pace. You got your rents and you more or less kept pace with inflation.
Wow.
So, and then the fourth one that that we looked at is housing, because, you know, and I think.
Talk about residential housing.
Where you live. And I think. So historically, and we have data from U.S., we have international data as well, like from Amsterdam and places like that had been around for a really long time and had sophisticated financial centers for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And the data is fairly consistent across the board that your house, your single family house, or maybe it's a row house in Amsterdam or whatever, maintains its real value and probably appreciates in real terms at something like 0.5% to 1% per year.
Over the long haul. I mean, not the same thing the last 10 years, but yeah.
Yeah, right. And if you want to look at the U.S. as a whole, you can look at the Case-Shiller Index or residential home prices. And I think it's way above trend line.
What a 7% Case-Shiller year over year on the 20 city, which is absurd considering high interest rates, but it's another story.
Yeah, it is another story. But so what I think people should do is, I think that the choice of whether you own the home, because you can't, in most markets, the product that's available to rent is basically a different product from the product that's available to own. Mm-hmm. And so I think people should think of buying a home as essentially a consumption decision. We did this. We didn't ever live in a house until we were going to have kids. Mm-hmm. We rented various places. And I think a lot of people do that. And the reason that you get a house is not because you think, oh, it's time to make a great investment. It's because I want the house, right? I want the room. I want the lawn or
storage.
Yeah, or whatever. I just don't want to raise my kids in an apartment or whatever. But financially, on a short-term basis, it's very easy to do the comparison, right? Mm-hmm. And usually renting is cheaper. But where it's different is if you're going to buy it and stay there for a long term and you can get a fixed rate mortgage, you will essentially benefit from locking in your costs. And inflation is, I think, is extremely likely to continue over the long run.
Well, it's essentially the difference between leasing and buying a car. If you're going to lease a car and you're going to be, okay, I'm 3 years, I'm out, let's get this done. Okay, that's interesting. You can say I want it for 22 years or 10 years. Well, probably buying is better. But what I do with my clients, I make the assumption. It's not an assumption. We ask if they have a house. And then look at that as, while it's not an investment, it is somewhat of a piece of real estate that we can assume is inside of your portfolio. Well, not really in your portfolio, but inside of your totality of your investments. And that alleviates us necessarily putting too much real estate in their portfolios.
Right, because you got to, if they own a home, for sure, you have to count that.
Yeah.
And so here's why it's not necessarily an investment. I mean, one that you expect a high return from. What people sometimes forget in their calculations is the carrying cost, right? If you let's say you put all cash, which most people don't do, but if you did, you wouldn't have a mortgage payment, but you'd still have the opportunity cost of that cash. Uh-huh. And so if the opportunity cost of that cash was, you would have otherwise had it, say, in the market. I don't know what you think in the long run return of the market, but somewhere 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever. Correct. You think that number is.
8% round.
That it's costing you that, if that's what you would do otherwise. And then on top of that, you got property taxes. And anyone who's ever owned a home knows all these things, right?
Sure.
You got property taxes, sure. You got right. Insurance, new you roof. Got maintenance.
Yeah.
And those things do add up. And you got to, if you're just looking at it from a purely investment point of view, you got to count those. And they're, I think depends where you are, how high your property taxes are. And your insurance probably varies depending, again, where you are. If you're in a flood zone or something like that, you're going to, if you're in Florida right now, I understand that it's pretty expensive to get, or California, where a lot of people live, and homeowners insurance is through the roof.
Oh, ridiculous.
But I agree with you. It is, the disadvantage from an investment point of view is, for most people, a home is a pretty concentrated asset, right? Because there's a lot of local, right? They say location, 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 but even within, a city could be a good city, but you could, you always hear stories about, that somebody opened a crack house around
sure.
the corner.
Of course. Of course. So if you could sum up all the things you've learned and all the things that, well, not all the things you learned, in totality, what you learned, and then how you can laser refine that to getting someone to understand, this may be a hard question, but understand of what is their best opportunity and what they should be doing in general. Is there something like that you had an aha moment from all this?
So if you were to say you can only ask one question about an investment.
Okay.
I would say the person should try to answer to him or herself, try to understand what is going to generate the return from this investment. Okay. Is it, and I'll just give you a very quick overview of the big high level investment class, which we just actually did a lot of.
Right.
If you look, it'd be interesting. I haven't done this, but it's kind of if you were to ask 10 or 100 or whatever people who have investments in the stock market, and you ask them, what's going to generate my investment returns over the long run? I wonder what they would say. Then anyone listening to this is going to at least have my answer. But when you look at the data over the long run, and when you think about it theoretically, it's essentially earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it, well, it's earnings and inflation, but inflation has to translate back into earnings. And that's what's generated the return in the stock market. A little bit of value, you look at the very long periods of time, a little bit of valuation change, right? The beginning of the 20th century, the PE of the market was in the low teens, and now it's probably double that. But over a very long period of time, that's not a very big amount per year on a compounded basis. Right. Mostly comes from earnings, which can be either reinvested or paid out as dividends.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells you the very, unless you're Buffett, you can't get 20% a year out of the stock market, because there just ain't going to be that kind of earnings across the board. You look at bonds, and we did this again, it's in the book. We actually did it the best predictor over a 10-year period on the state. We use the 10-year because that's where the data is. Very long period of time. The best predictor for your return on the 10-year is the coupon when you buy it. Or I should say the yield when you buy it, because the coupon's pretty close to that yield, but it's the purchase price yield, yield at purchase. Mm-hmm. And that in bonds, it's very easy to see. You look at, then you look at some of these speculative vehicles, say crypto. Mm-hmm. Well, crypto doesn't produce any cash flows. The only cash flow you can expect to get from crypto is when you sell it.
It has no earnings either.
It has no earnings, right? Has no earnings. And so you have to have some, assuming that if you ask this question, what's going to generate the return? You realize, well, I have to sell it for a higher price.
Right.
And then you have to ask yourself, well, what's going to make someone want to buy it for a higher price? It's kind of hard to answer that question in crypto, except for, you know, what's not flatteringly called the greater fool theory. Mm-hmm. In any investment, and that's really one way to tell, to tell the difference between a speculation and an investment. But there are lots of investments that are real investments. Excuse me. And raw land is one of them, when you talked about that a little bit, right? Raw land costs you money to hold. And so you have to have some vision of either what you're going to do in terms of developing it or what you think someone else is going to do in terms of developing it.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, Dr. Roger Silk and Catherine, his daughter, co-authors of The Investor's Dilemma Decoded, talks about things like gold and mutual funds as a vehicle to invest in asset classes. And kind of as I went through this also, things like we talked about risk, of course, but time value of money. Those are all fascinating things, but, you know, can be a little bit dry. But I think that you've done a great job at putting this forward. So grab yourself a book out there. Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
That's going to wrap it up for this show, this edition, this podcast episode of The Disciplined Investor. Thank you so much for joining me. Next week, we have an unbelievable guest coming on talking about the ins and outs, everything you want to know and that I want to know about AI. Thank you so much for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.